Sorry, there's a child outside my house having a meltdown, like a meltdown.
Wow.
See
It's
if you can
very theatrical.
eavesdrop, find out what it's about.
I don't know, he's not saying anything. He's like five.
No.
Damn.
He's just shrieking.
5-year-olds do be doing that.
Anyway, if you're just tuning in, welcome. This is Mango Masala, the South Asian show, here on Pi Radio, Manchester's number one youth led radio station. My name's Gaines. I'm here with Halima and Simran.
Hello.
And, I mean, do we really need any more intro? Just...
Guys, not straight into it.
Guys, what is going on?
What is going on?
What is going on? Marvin Gaye.
What is going on?
Tell us we're kind of matching today.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did think that.
Oh, we look like we're going to the riots ourselves. Look,
oh,
Simran's got the white
God,
and we're in the
we've
red.
We've got the red. God.
For those who haven't caught on yet, what we are referring to is the past 2 weeks of violent unrest across England. And
I'm about to go outside and I'm going to sort that kid out.
Right. Okay. Let's calm down, Simran. This is what we're trying to promote, peace prevailing.
I cannot explain how nuts this kid has just gone.
Right, well, we can't hear him, so from our perspective, we're
okay.
All fine. You'll
as long
just
as
have
you
to,
guys can't hear him.
Yeah. But yeah, the past 2 weeks, guys. What a week. What a day. What
no,
a week.
Guys, yeah. Guys, it might have been crazy for you. Imagine how crazy it was for me. Mm. What an absolutely insane time to be a British Bangladeshi. Honestly, both.
Oh, yeah, that's, yeah.
What an insane time to be a British Bangladeshi. Both of my countries have been in complete disarray to two very different ends. But there was a point where have you seen that meme where it's like one eye that way, one eye that way? It was literally like I've just been on holiday, guys. I've literally just come back from holiday like 2 days ago. And there were days on my holiday where I was spending the whole day I could not keep my eyes off the news, like just stressed. My blood pressure has been high.
Like, what a time for us to take like a few weeks off
literally
what happened that we covered in the last episode, and then to have like a little bit of time in between episodes this time round.
A week and a half.
You know,
and everything that's gone on in the last week.
It's
oh,
so funny.
My God.
Because we always, whenever we do a pre-record, we're always like, oh yeah, I guess something might have happened by next week. And it's always then that the most
crazy
just...
things happen.
There was a time, guys, where we used to struggle for like what to talk about.
Crazy.
What? Oh, those were the days.
Do you remember like just over a year ago we used to be like, what should we cover? Like, and now
was that the kid? I can hear them.
Oh my God.
Yeah, probably.
Oh my gosh. Right.
It's driving me insane.
Right. Let's add a bit of structure to this, guys. So like Halima said, for a British Bangladeshi person, this is insane because literally in both of your associated countries, stuff's hitting the fan.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk a bit about Bangladesh in a bit because I would say ultimately from your
that's
perspective
That's more like
anyway,
the happy news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From Halima's perspective and for a lot of Bangladeshi's perspectives, obviously because they've literally overturned the government, they are happy about that. But
in the UK, however.
Yeah, let's talk about the UK. So obviously, I think this most recent violence was kickstarted in the wake of what we can't go without saying, a horrific attack that happened not that far from here, actually, in Southport.
Yeah.
Obviously, we now know that a 17-year-old stabbed a number of people at a Taylor Swift themed dance party for young kids, which is obviously just, I think whenever like kids are involved in anything, obviously it's just 10 times worse, but like it's just really sad. Obviously 3 children lost their lives. That in itself was really sad. However, in the wake of that, the police did say they're not treating this as any form of extremism or terrorism or whatever. They came out and said that. But suddenly there was this spur of misinformation across we'll say mainly like programs like Twitter, like websites like Twitter Online, people spurring saying, oh, he's a Muslim, oh, he's this, he's an asylum seeker, he's a refugee, blah, blah, blah. All this misinformation, none of which is true. The person who committed this attack actually is literally born and raised in Wales, and their parents, I believe, are from Rwanda. Not that that is any matter of concern anyway. But yeah, this misinformation was running rife to the point where I think the police eventually did come out and say that he's not got any links to Islam, just because so many people were perpetuating these lies online. Obviously, then various visuals were happening for the children that died. And at one of these, like, stuff just majorly kicked off with basically a load of far-right associated, and I think it's fair for us to say, people with racist ideologies turned up to these this visual. Bear in mind, they turned up to this visual with alcohol, which is a bit like, if you're actually going to pay your respects to these kids, why are you turning up with 6 cans of cider? Not really sure what's going on there. But yeah, things kicked off in Southport at this visual. Things turned violent. I think it goes without saying as well, I think I've referred to this as racist attacks, but I think at this at its core, it is also definitely right for us to say that these attacks on the South Asian and POC community across the UK are undoubtedly Islamophobic. That is how this has all started. But in case I haven't made it clear enough, basically, the far right has risen. Like, I wouldn't want to say they've come back, because ultimately these people will have always had this sentiment, and they will have always been here. And we know that Britain, as we said for the past 4 years, Britain is not a racist country, essentially. This has always been here. It's just, I think that first like riot, that first violence at that Southport visual, just gave the far right confidence across the land to then go and carry out a number of more what they would call protests, but in reality really are racist riots with a fascist agenda. I think, again, it's fair for us to say, what are they protesting against? You can't even say there's anti-immigration. You can't say that it's a protest, because ultimately at its core it's hateful rhetoric.
Just
the past couple of weeks have just been, every couple of days we've seen unrest across a number of locations in the country, various places of worship, particularly mosques, getting attacked, people being hounded in the street purely for the way that they look. It's been a very, very scary time for a lot of people of color, and especially in the Muslim community as well. I mean, I pass on to Halima now, because obviously you are actually a member of that community. So
yeah, I think like there's so many levels to this. Like, really, truly, there's so many levels to this. And as Carlos said, really what's at the crux of it is kind of an Islamophobia that is so deeply entrenched into the fabric of British society and politics and policy. And this is not a standalone event. This is not a freak incident. This hasn't come out in a vacuum as a self-isolated thing. This is a continuation of a kind of institutional Islamophobia and racism that we have been seeing, and that you can really trace a very clear, like, definitive, genealogy of this kind of Islamophobia and racism for decades now in this country, especially recently. You know, when people like Keir Starmer are coming forward and saying things like, you know, Bangladeshis are kind of needing to be deported, or they're here illegally or whatever, it's not a surprise then that people will kind of take that rhetoric and somehow kind of let it evolve into what we've seen over the past few weeks. Like, it doesn't come out of nowhere. It's a top down kind of system where our politicians and they have created hostile environments for Muslims and people of color and the lower class people who are in difficult positions, because this is what happens when there are times of deprivation, when people are in poverty, when people are in need, they're always going to look for someone to blame. We have seen time and time again in history, like one of the largest kind of most well-documented fascist movements in the world, Nazism. How did Hitler come to... Anyone who studied anything about Nazism will know that Hitler was able to kind of garner so much power was because the German people at that time were in such destitution. And that's how fascism rises, and that's how politics and our politicians have a role in because they're the ones actually to blame for people's destitution. They're the ones to blame for poverty. But because they don't want to accept that blame, they'll say, oh, it's because of there's too many migrants coming, people are not being deported enough, blah 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 blah, and these people are of color and they're from these countries and they're Muslims. And that's why we've ended up with what we've ended up over the past few weeks. You know, it's not, as I say, it's not an isolated event. It is an extremely terrifying time, I think, for people of color and like specifically for Muslims. As I say, like the Carlos said, obviously, he mentioned that there was a lot of misinformation at the heart of this, but it wasn't ordinary uneducated, because a lot of the kind of counter protesters, the things that they're saying is that, oh, the far right extremists, they're just uneducated and blah, 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 blah. But it's actually not. Like, one of the people who was spreading this misinformation was Nigel Farage. Like our a British, like, politician, you know, acting British politician right now who holds institutional constitutional power, Nigel Farage. And he did an interview afterwards where he said, I got the information off Andrew Tate.
A very reliable source.
I got the information.
That was sarcasm, in case it didn't go across already.
Like, that is crazy. That is absolutely insane. There was no due diligence. But because these people are gagging for a reason to victimize Muslims and people of color, that they'll take a rumor is good enough for them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I mean, Simran as well, obviously, I think, from what I've seen, there maybe are different experiences that people are having north v south as well. Like, I feel like also, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of the actual far right stuff has actually been going on above the Midlands, I want to say. So
a lot of it has been very emboldened in the north. And it's not surprising because those are where there are greater, I guess, larger areas of destitution in those areas. Like,
yeah, so, I think it seems that way. I think, sorry, go on.
So I was gonna say, so what's it been like for you, obviously?
I think this is one of those, I think this is one of those times where I'd say, like, I'm very lucky to live where I live. That's not to say that there wasn't mosques and places of worship here that weren't threatened, and then there was people outside and stuff like that. Like, things have happened, but obviously, given the fact that I live in a community full of people of color, and I just think, like, because of the north-south divide and things like that, kind of what Halima touched on, that we haven't been touched as much here. But then I know in, like, northwest London, where there's a lot of immigration centres and also hotels that are housing people, they were massively threatened in, like, Harrow and stuff. Was, like, there was a big issue going on there. So it's not to say that it hasn't been happening here, but I will say, this is probably more for later on in the conversation, but I'll touch on it now, that it's, like, that thing, the really big threat in Walthamstow in London then got met with the thousands of people out in the streets who then counter protests. And that was, you know, a little bit of like silver lining to all this. It was quite heartwarming to see. And I feel like you saw those kind of like people come together and stand up against racism and fascism in this instance. And it does show that there's a lot of people that still, that belong to all walks of life and all faiths and backgrounds, that still support that side of it.
Yeah. So I mean, let's talk about that. So
hang on, I just want to say one more thing. Like, I completely like this is a nice thing to say, but I'm personally right now, that to me isn't making much difference. Like,
It's not, but I feel like it stopped what was supposed to be a huge riot in Walthamstow that day. Like, it was going to, I saw Walthamstow everywhere that day, and the people were bordering up their shops and stuff. So for that to happen, and then I saw on, like, I saw a few videos of different places in London. I want to say, like, Lewisham and stuff, that people were out and they were, like, talking about how we're not going to let them win and stuff like that.
It is heartwarming to see that there are people, but I just feel like it's kind of, for me personally, that I don't know. It's hard because it's like, I don't want to just be overly negative, but I just feel like we shouldn't be in this situation in the first place.
Of course not.
Do you know what I mean?
Of course not.
Like, we shouldn't have to be boarding up shops. We shouldn't have to be relying on other white people to be allies. Like, the thing, and this is the thing that I was going to say, is that I think the thing, because it's not the first time there have been kind of like clashes and protests and things like that. Carlos, I don't know what's just come up on the screen. It's not the first time that there have been clashes and protests, and it's not the first time we've seen, you know, the EDL or the far right in action. However, I think for me this time it was a little bit different just because of how pervasive it was. And because usually when we think of the EDL and we think of the far right, we think of kind of the white working class population. And it's very easily explained away as like, oh, it's people who are ignorant, people who are not educated, people who don't know better, don't have anything else to do because they're jobless, blah, blah, blah. Like, that's kind of what people say. But this time around, it's felt like to me as though it's been like a nationwide protest. Not to say that it's all white people, of course not, but there are also demographics of white people who have been involved in the protests and the clashes this time around that wouldn't necessarily fit the stereotype of far right or like an EDL member. And I think that that to me is just kind of proof of how far like far right extremism has come in the UK, that it's now beginning to encompass so many different demographics of people that you wouldn't typically associate with this type of movement. And that's what makes it so terrifying, because, you know, Simran said that she felt relatively safe because she was in somewhere like Slough, which is kind of like an immigrant stronghold. I obviously am from Longside. All of my family are still in Longside. And we also thought like, okay, they're not gonna dare come into Longside. Like, there's too many of us. We're gonna, you know, outnumber them. And yet, just on a few days ago, I was out in Longside. My cousin was separately out in Longside. She had to call me to be like, can you come pick up my daughters? Because I'm out shopping and I've just seen police detain a man who is literally carrying acid. And he's in Longside Market, the heart of Longside, you know? So the thing for me that's so scary is how pervasive it is, and therefore how much it has emboldened people. You know, usually we see these kinds of clashes in big numbers. You know, people will come out as a group and do it. This time around, we've been seeing lone rangers, you know, like there have been lone people acting.
No, but that... Sorry, that's what I was going to say. It was giving the purge. That's when I was like, it's literally giving the purge, because people had their own agendas. And I was going to say, like, just quickly to butt in, like Kalima said, like, now it's transcending class. Like, it's not just like that typical, stereotypical image that you see of someone that you think might belong to the far right or the EDL. Like, it's transcending what we previously thought these people looked like and acted like. And like I said, it used to be like mob mentality and group behavior, and now it's no longer that. You have these lone rangers that are seeking out their own motives and seeking out their own victims, right? Which is the most terrifying part. And I would say, like, not for a second did I feel safe in Slough. I had that like safety in numbers thing, but like my grandmother got called a slur by some like 8-year-old boys out on the high street.
God.
Like, and then I go to the gym in like a very still mixed but probably predominantly white area, and I still felt like just anxious, and I was just like anything could happen, and like I just was very nervous just to be in that area as well. Like, I feel like I'm speaking from a place where obviously there's a lot more migrants that live here, so I get the difference of living in like a very white area, and like for my friends that do live in very white areas, I'm very scared for them. But it doesn't, that's would not to go without saying, like, it was still scary here, and especially in London as well. And I think the bottom line is that, like, this was never about what happened in Southport.
No. Yeah, of course not.
It just shows the potency.
Does anyone know the names of the three girls? Like, these protesters, if you ask an average one of them, I highly doubt that they would know the names of those girls.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the girls is literally, I believe, of, like, Iberian heritage, like Spain, Portugal, etc. She literally has a literally. So
it's just like, sorry, Simran.
Yeah, so it was never about those three girls and everybody else who was attacked that day. It was never about that. It just shows the potency of social media in igniting this aggression and this hatred, and the media in inciting this kind of violence and aggression, and the way that they pandered to it without calling it what it was, which was a riot, and calling it a protest and like British nationalism and things like that. Like, it's just so, it was so scary this week, to be honest. And like, I think it goes so beyond what anyone thought that this group of people were capable of, because of the way that it's been kind of different to past instances. And then what was the last thing I was going to say? Was just that, like I think, Carlos, you touched on it, like, they just needed an excuse.
Yeah.
It wasn't about anything. It was just the initial jump of like, oh, we think it's a Muslim man that did this. And then they didn't need confirmation of anything. It was just cool. We're outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there is a conversation to be had as well. I think both of you have kind of touched on it, in that when people think about the far right and about like the people that have this kind of mentality or that will go out and participate in these riots, they do think of the white working class. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of think pieces over the past couple of days about how, well, first of all, I would see quite a few kind of jokes online just kind of basically taking the mickey out of how supposedly anyone who takes part in this these protests are either they don't have any intelligence, or they don't lack basic social skills, or they lack like personal hygiene, blah blah blah. Which, of course, like I think we've said before, like negative people, like it does tend to show in their what they call their features, whatever. It's the whole like Roald Dahl the twits analogy, whatever. Yeah. Anyway, aside from that, it's a very fine line that's crossed where people actually think that they're being like, let's speak down on these people with these horrible ideologies. And actually what they end up doing is actually being classist, because they're basically insinuating that these people are like this purely, but like, they're basically making fun of this sector of society that, not that they don't know any better, but there is a reason why they are more susceptible to this.
And also
they then are completely forgetting about the flip side of this, which is that whilst these this section of society are attempting to perpetuate white supremacy, the people that are actually benefiting the most from this are the rich white people at the other end of the scale, who are basically benefiting from what the white working class are doing without having to do anything themselves. And
it shifts the real blame.
No one's been coming, like, for example, like even someone like Elon Musk, for example. He's not in the UK.
My God, like,
he owns X, instigating I think his main thing is two-tier care. He's basically trying to insinuate that like British people of colour receive one kind of treatment in the UK, i.e. a positive one when it comes to jail sentences, whereas white people don't. But that being said, he's been doing this in plain sight. And yeah, I've seen so much more basically making fun of the white working class rather than the people at the top of the chain.
That's exactly my point. Like, this is not a self kind of isolated incident. This did not arise from a vacuum. This is a top down, as I say, kind of structure. And there's the government really benefit from infighting, actually, because all whilst we're blaming only one demographic of people, who, by the way, they are also to be held to account, but while we're only blaming them, the government are being let off and the politicians are being let off for kind of instigating the institutional level of Islamophobia and racism.
A literal Labour MP, there's a video from a couple of weeks ago where she's literally, I think she's for Tamworth or something, and she's literally standing up in Parliament saying, oh, my constituents want their hotel back, talking about...
Is that hotel your dad's hotel that you want it back? What do you mean you want it back?
And like, I think that specific hotel then got like an attack during these riots as well.
Yeah.
So
then there was also another incident with a Tory MP's wife when she literally came onto it when she was
said
like,
that they
burn
should
it
be
all.
Burnt alive.
Burn it all, you know, like, and this is the thing, right? This is the thing, because it's like, I think the riots have more or less kind of started to simmer a little bit now. But having spoken before about how pervasive it is, like to the point where there's been international coverage on it, there have been a number of countries that have issued travel advisory warnings to their citizens for the UK. Like, that's how bad the situation has gotten. And even though, yes, there are, you know, factions of society who have stood up and been allies and blah, 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 to have this many people, as I say, it felt very nationwide. I'm now never going to feel fully comfortable. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like this is just different. It's different to anything that we've, any kind of clashes that we've seen beforehand. And I feel like I'm now always going to be very hyper aware and very hyper cognizant of, like, what does this person actually think of me? Yeah. When I'm out and about and by myself, I'm going to be thinking, is this person going to potentially attack me? You know, like, you're, as a brown Muslim woman, you're always very hypercognizant of racism and Islamophobia, but now it's to the point where, because you know that funny little myth that everyone perpetuates, like all British racism is just a little bit more subtle. That is an absolutely indefensible position to take now. Like, you cannot say that. It is not subtle. We have had actual race riots in the country. And I think like from now, like just forevermore now, Muslim people, people of colour, we're just always going to not be comfortable.
Yeah, you know? I think I've spoken about this before, though. Like, we've always had that discomfort within us before any of this even happened, right? Like, we've always been hyper aware of how we stand in this country and how we're treated and how we're viewed, right? But now that's, like, been tenfolded because of everything that's happened. And it's, like, now the simple act of this week texting every single person I know, telling them to be safe and to be careful when they go out, if they have to go out, telling my grandma to stay inside and to wear English clothes when she goes out, because if she's wearing her like Indian outfit, then it's just, you know, she becomes even more of a target that way. Like, this is 2024 Britain. That's absolutely insane to me. And I think, like, back to the point of like having the people who are out rioting looking a certain way and kind of memifying that and making that funny and saying they look X, Y, and Z, right? That, like Halima said, absolves the people who uphold these white supremacist standards in institutions, in politics, in our day-to-day lives, in the day-to-day lives that we live as people of colour in the UK.
I think what's so significant about this like latest kind of round of riots and protests is that I don't think it will be forgotten. Like, I really, the way that I see it... Is it recording? The way that I see it is that it is now a kind of a watershed moment. I feel as though like we will now never be able to get to a place like before this. And the politicians now cannot ignore that that kind of there is such a fraught tension simmering kind of in the underbelly of British society that has actually come to the forefront now, you know, like it just cannot be ignored. It cannot be brushed to the side. We cannot explain it away as a minority of uneducated working class people. It has taken an absolute hold of mainstream British society and it needs to be addressed properly, as in I'm talking policy. You know, there needs to be laws in place to deal with this. We cannot have a repeat of what has just happened. Because if it is, it will be worse. You know?
Yeah. Because I was going to say, like, I feel like even in that, what you're saying is almost underplaying it. Like, what this last week or so has revealed is an appetite for violence, an appetite for destruction, an appetite for bloodshed from these people, right? And it's reached new levels of scary. And that's what we're up against.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We can't just go back to normal now. We can't just go back and pretend that we don't know that there's an entire demographic of British people that absolutely hate our guts and want us gone and will not hesitate to enact violence onto us.
Like, the level of mobilization that we've seen from them, that's scary. Like, I think it goes to say, like what Simran was saying about the level of mobilization that has then counteracted that when needed is heartwarming in a sense. But the fact that that was able to mobilize in itself, first of all, then that could happen again just like that, is very scary. And
I don't want to have to rely on the goodwill of other white people to
exactly.
be safe.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I want there to be actual laws and policies and on a fundamental level, a deep societal change, like a deep societal cultural reform, you know? And that starts with the people who are actually in the first place even perpetuating this. So I don't feel very hopeful for it, but whatever.
Yeah, like Nigel Farage, like, for example, someone that we've talked about that has literally spread this misinformation is a literal MP. So,
and like, I was going to say, like, I feel like it goes a lot deeper for a lot of us as well. Like, growing up as like maybe second or third generation of this country, like, we all collectively right now feel this sense of like threat and fear, and we all feel vulnerable in the last week or so from what's happened in the situation. But a lot of us have also grown up hearing stories of what's happened in the last few decades. P-word bashing and other racially motivated hate crimes and stuff like that. That was portrayed in the media as a game in itself. People were encouraged to go and partake in that. So I think collectively, us, our parents, our grandparents, we have this sense of trauma following hearing these stories. And like,
absolutely,
what the things that have happened this week is very much a real threat to us right now. But also it speaks to decades of violence that have taken place and affected people that we know and love.
And the legacy of racism and Islamophobia that has never left never left Britain. Like, people will look at that era of kind of fascism and P-word bashing and act as though they're so far removed from it. I mean, firstly, it was not, like, chronologically that long ago.
Less than half a century.
My dad, like, who was in this country, my dad, my uncles, my family members who first came to this country, like, the stories that they have, especially having been lived up north, because they was in Oldham, and Oldham was, like, a massive site of race riots. It's like, I don't know if you guys, people will know, but like, historically, it has been a huge site of racial tension and racial riots. Bradford, Oldham, those kinds of places. So they have stories for days. And the average Brit, I guess, would look at that and think like, oh, we're so far removed from that, though. You know, like, that kind of stuff doesn't happen anymore. And we've seen this kind of rhetoric fly all over British kind of mainstream society. Racism is not a thing. We've even went as far as having a South Asian prime minister. And yet, at the very end of his premiership, it's not been very long that he's been gone. Look at what we're dealing with.
I think there's something to be said there as well, in that there will have been a lot of people who have just voted in this last general election with the aim of being like, oh, Tories out, we're moving into this new era.
Right.
Everything's looking up now. Look what's happened literally like a couple of months in. And that's not to say, well, I think we can definitely say that Keir's Bangladesh statement, for example, hasn't helped this. But it's not to say that, oh, it's all Keir Starmer's fault. But what it is to say is that I think people shouldn't, like, think that things have drastically changed now. Look, these problems are still here, and they were hit. I think people kind of were guilty of maybe attributing it purely to, oh, it's these 15 years of Tory rule, and once we're rid of them, everything will be better. Clearly not.
Because you inherit what has happened in those 15 years. And what has happened in those 15 years is Tory austerity, which puts people in deprivation, which then prompts them to look for someone to blame. And then on top of that, you have Tory Islamophobia and racism. And we've said before on the show that there are reports on this. And then you couple that together, and then you get this. You get a demographic of people who are kind of just looking for someone to blame, who are restless, who are often forgotten, who are not tended to, and they are looking for someone to blame. And then when a politician comes along and says, oh, actually, it's because of the migrants, it's because of the Muslims, that's where their energy and their kind of hatred is going to go.
I think also, like, I would implore that anyone that has, in particular, like, non-POC from the past, like, couple of weeks that have stood up against or have attended, I'll say, counter-protests, even though I don't think they're countering another protest, but counter-protests. People who have attended that, people who have, like, actively took steps in the right direction, thank you, I suppose, for also, like, the bare minimum. But also, please don't think that this is where that ends. I think there will be a lot of people out there that maybe have, like, attended a rally or something this week, or shared something on the story and think, tick, that's me done, racism over, back to normal, yay. Like, no, first of all, because, like, we've just been discussing, this had never been, it was just waiting to kind of kick off again. And secondly, it's just fighting against racism, you can't, like, pick and choose it. I think I've said before, like, it's not enough to, like, not be racist. You have to actually be anti-racist. And you might think, like, now that, because I think people worried, I think, because obviously what happened on Wednesday, I don't think we've actually said this on here, but just to give context to anyone that doesn't know, on Wednesday there were a series of supposed far-right riots, rallies, whatever you want to call it, basically insinuating that they were going to be violent, taking place across the UK. There was a leaked, like, 30 locations, like, one of which was literally, like, close to where me and Halima live, right on Cheadle, near the mosque as well.
That's right outside my house. Okay, I'm not to give away where I live, but it's literally right outside my house. There was a police van outside there all day, because I drove past, like, back and forth a few times.
But, yeah, so that's very worrying that this has been leaked. And I think in the days leading up to that as well, there were so many scary videos leaked, one of whom literally involving in Salford this man running after a Muslim couple with gardening. Well, I do want to say, I don't think, just to be completely clear, I don't think it's a chainsaw, I think it's gardening equipment, but that's still very scary.
Right.
Like, still, like, horrific scenes there. So that was literally the day before. So I think there was a sense, like, on Wednesday of, oh, like, stuff could really, like, be bad today and, like, really scary. Like, I think Wednesday was a day where everyone was just kind of a bit on edge. And obviously, like, we've seen across, like, the majority of these locations, counter-protests turned out in their, like, thousands. If there were any far-right, rioters there, they were dealt with quickly and easily outnumbered. There was a sense of, like I say, relief. That being said, I think anyone, and also now, I think they were scared for this weekend. But as far as I've seen, touch wood, I don't think there's been anything that bad. Like, I literally noticed, you know, right? I was driving up here, and over the past 2 days, I've seen three police speeding car things.
Oh, I've been seeing that a lot, exactly.
And but I didn't see them over the, when it was all the like riots and stuff. So I was like, right, so clearly they're back to normal. they're not being called out to places. Clearly they've got better things to be doing, apparently. But that being said, I don't think that people shouldn't think, oh yeah, it's all gone back to normal, because like Kalima said,
it never will.
Yeah, it won't.
It's very much not over. Like, this is always going to be part of our experience now growing up in this country, and it's always going to be in the back of our heads, that lack of safety, that lack of trust that we'll have looking at other people in the street. Like, it's never going to go away. Like, if you're not a person of color and you uploaded something to your Instagram story and you were like, cool, job done, that's not enough. I'm sorry. Like, that doesn't just mean racism's over, and that doesn't put you in our shoes.
No.
I think, you know what the terrifying thing is that if you look at how this all started, we've said it was a rumor. It was one rumor.
That's all they
that
needed.
That sparked this whole thing. But the thing that worries me is that, like, what's it going to take next time? Because I do believe, unfortunately, that there will be a next time.
Well, I was really worried, you know, because obviously it's a relief that it was halted. But apparently there was an ISIS plot to attack the recent Taylor Swift concert in Austria, to the point that they've all been cancelled. And that happened, I think, on Wednesday or Thursday. So I was very worried in the wake of that, being like, oh, here we go again. Like, people are going to be very Islamophobic and blah, blah, blah. But thankfully...
There's actually no rest for us, my God.
Thankfully, I shouldn't be having to say thankfully, but it does seem that they haven't necessarily picked up on that like they were going to. But yeah... Like, I was like,
you're just scared, you're
that.
Worried because there's always going to be people who commit crime and do bad things, and like, we're just all going to be answerable now. From now on, every person of color, every Muslim that ever does anything bad, we are, as always, but now especially, we will just be answerable to that, you know. And it's just, it's a very, very tense kind of way to live your life, especially in your country. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm born here. Like, this is my country. This is all I've ever known. And, like, I feel so uncomfortable. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know that thing? You probably guys have seen it on Instagram. It was like a billboard and it was like, we didn't come to Britain. Britain came to us. And it's just like the bare bones, like the historical background behind us guys even being here. And, like, black and brown people being here in the first place.
Exactly.
The average person... especially the average person that was in the riots this week, is not going to pick up the history book and learn that.
Right.
All they need is the Nigel Farage on TV, the Andrew Tate, someone on X, Elon Musk. All they need is that and a fake name after a tragedy has happened.
Right.
For them to take up arms.
But this is why it's so multi-layered, because it's not a situation where we could just be like, oh, they're kind of standalone actors, you know? Like, this is so deeply entrenched into British, like, the fabric of British society, as I say, that it even starts from, like, the education, like, curriculum. You know, it even starts from teaching people, why do we have such kind of, you know, large migration in the first place? It's because, as Simran said, a lot of people aren't even aware of the colonial history of Britain. You know, like, it's going to take so much. And I don't trust our government and our elite class to do what it's going to take.
That's what I'm kind of saying, is like, when we were talking about the look of these protesters or rioters, whatever you want to call them, in that stereotypical fashion, or they look like this, or they belong to this group, or they don't have these hygiene practices, or whatever, right? We're absolving the people who
are really
sit
to blame,
in an office, and they sit in power, in positions of power, and they uphold white supremacy in healthcare, in education, in politics, in every part of the fabric of British society. Mm-hmm. And they let these values trickle down to children.
Yep.
And we're not even taking the time to educate people on why we're here in the first place and what our actual stance on migrants is, and, you know, and why we belong to these conventions in the first place and things like that, and the rights that people have to be here. Like, I had LBC on in the car.
Oh, you're brave.
Someone needs to start brave. Doing better screening for who is allowed on that show, because, oh my God, that is just rage bait. That show is pure rage bait.
Yeah. Exactly it. But, you know, like, it's so funny as well, like, talking about what... Like, this kind of goes without saying. Like, I often don't try... I try not to even, like, dignify that kind of far-right thinking. But it's just so funny because it's like... They're calling us like immigrants, and they're telling us go back home and go back to where you come from. Which, by the way, like we're born here, you know, in the first place. Secondly, I find it hilarious because a lot of people, are not actually aware of like the actual inner machinations of British migration. People seem to have this idea that there's, you know, that British immigration forces are stood at the border and they're just saying, everyone come in, you know, here's money and here's a house and here's a car and blah, 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 blah. That's not how it works. British immigration laws are already so strict. Like, I say this as, like, I don't know if I've shared this story before on radio, but my maternal grandmother, she's the only grandparent that I have left. She's old, she's senile, like she's about 80 odd, whatever. She's lived her whole life in Bangladesh. She obviously, her daughter, my mum, has been in this country for about 30 odd years. She has grandchildren here. She has a sister here. She has numerous nieces and nephews. Like, she has so much family here, right? And a couple of years ago, this was quite while I was actually still in high school, we tried really hard to get my grandma a visa to come and visit us because she has so much family here. We want her to see how we live. We want her to see our life, right? And we tried maybe about 3 times to apply for a visitor visa. Each time she got rejected. Each time.
On what basis?
And the basis is that they don't think she has enough reason to go back. So they think she's going to stay. And by the way, this process is long and it's arduous and it costs a lot of money because each time you have to pay for the applications, you have to pay for various kind of like documents, you have to pay for people to come and do an inspection of your house to inspect that your house is all right for her to come and like visit and stay in. Like, it costs so much money and you know what's so funny as well? You know what's crazy? Is that my grandma was born as a British subject. My grandma was born under colonial India. Like, she was born when Britain was still occupying the subcontinent. She was literally considered a British subject. And 70 years later, she can't get a visa to visit the colonial heartland that ruled over the subcontinent for about 400 odd years. And then people in this country have the audacity to say that we have such easy immigration laws and like they just be letting anyone in, and it's like you guys aren't actually aware of the reality of the situation, of what it's like for people to even try to get in, and secondly what it's like once they do get in.
Yeah. And that's it.
Also,
she's not even trying to get in as well.
She wants to visit her daughter.
My first thought was like, she didn't have reason to go back. Is like, what does that say? Like, what of her livelihood in Bangladesh? Like, do you think so low of the average person in Bangladesh that they would just come here and be like, oh, well, I'm going to give everything up there now?
That's my point. Like, people are not aware of how people from like the global south who actually try to come to the UK are treated. And not that I think that it matters, but Bangladesh is a Commonwealth country. You know, like, if anything, we have a right to be here.
It's not funny.
It's ridiculous, but that's my point. Like, the you lot that are out there like rioting and kicking off and saying we have too much mass migration, like, you don't actually know the reality of what it takes to get to Britain and then what it takes to live in Britain as a migrant and as an immigrant. My uncle recently just immigrated from Bangladesh like 2 years ago, so he doesn't have his citizenship yet or whatever. He just has a right to work here. And I see the kind of acrobatics that man has to do, the kind of bureaucracy that he has to. It's crazy. That amount of money that it costs.
Oh.
It's insane. And you lot are acting like they're just here and the government are just like, here's a car and here's a house and here's £20,000. Like, no.
For asylum seekers, I'm pretty sure the figure is as well. It's 35 quid a week. So it's like £5 a day that you're meant to live on.
Meanwhile, look at MPs' expenses. You want someone to blame for your destitution? Look at the MPs' expenses.
Yeah.
I want to touch on that actually after, about like the good migrant trope and like the
I was just about to say that.
I was going to say one thing quickly. Mianka reposted this on TikTok, and I think it was from LBC, but I'm not 100% sure. But it was a clip about just the lack of education of the people that are calling in. But it just obviously is a representative of a wider group of people as well. But like, I just, he was saying like, the caller was basically saying like, why don't they go to France and Germany? Why don't they go to France and Germany? And then the guy was like, where have you found these numbers? And he couldn't say and stuff like that. Like, just, they don't know where they're getting these numbers and facts from, right? But they're using it to parade around this like idea in their heads. And the person who picked up the phone who was on the show was like, they take in more migrants than we do. Yeah. Like, they are going to those countries. Yeah. What do you mean?
Yeah.
Right, let's talk about this, because you just remind, yeah. Let's go.
There's a big thing of just like, I'm probably not going to articulate this the best, but like of people saying that I've been in this country for X, and this person's been in this country for this amount of decades, and their sons are doctors and lawyers and all these different things, right? And it kind of is that performative acrobatics, is what I said, was like of showing the great British public that like, we can come to your country and have good jobs. I'm saying this in air commas, like have good jobs and like contribute to society in a meaningful mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. But that just diminishes the experience of people that are not, because not everyone is going to be a doctor or a lawyer or whatever. Like mm-hmm. it's just, you guys say it.
There's no need. I'm sorry, but
yeah, there's just no need.
Sorry.
No, it's a very well known phenomenon, and it's a trope. It's called the good immigrant, and it's basically this idea, and this is actually funnily enough, is actually how British migration policy works. And we've seen them try to further kind of solidify it when they've tried to, you know, put in new migration laws. When we spoke a few months ago about how they want to increase the threshold of a migrant salary or whatever, it's this idea that they want the good immigrants, you know, they want, and America, Australia, I think, have what they call like a points-based system. I know the UK has been trying to implement this for a long time, and we're not far off, but it's essentially this idea that they want the good type of immigration. They want the people who are going to have the high kind of status jobs, the high salary jobs and whatever. And I think what's ended up happening is that a lot of immigrants have in turn kind of internalized a lot of this rhetoric, and they feel as though they need to kind of prove their worth to the British state in order to kind of legitimize their own citizenship. You know, first and foremost, citizenship is the single most basic universal human right that every single person on this earth, even a criminal, is entitled to unconditionally. There should be, this is international law, there cannot be any conditions to citizenship. It is the most universal human right. So therefore, when I'm seeing these people of colours, and I see a lot of Muslims do this as well, when they kind of do these acrobatics to prove how much they have integrated into British society, you know, I pay this much tax and I have this job and my brother has this job and my dad has this job and, you know, we give charity and we do community work and all of these things. And it's like, great, I earnestly love to see it. But you do not need to do all of those things to be deserving of a British citizenship. Like, you are a British citizen. You have citizenship because you are a British citizen. Full stop. Even if you were a, like, you know, low-lying, low-class, uneducated criminal, you would still have a right to British citizenship. Like, that is unconditional. You know, whether or not you'll be in prison is a different thing. But you that cannot never be taken away from you. And I want Muslim people and people of colour to stop doing this performative acrobatics to prove their worth. Like, you don't need to do that, because there are some people who have kind of very blue-collar jobs and they're also just as deserving to be here.
Yeah. I think as well, it's like, do you really think that by saying that, like, oh, I'm this, that the people...
It's going to make a difference,
yeah,
like...
Like, these people on the ground are the same people that are simultaneously saying that, oh...
You're taking their jobs.
But also that they're coming here and not working. So it's kind of like, do you really think they actually are going to go as far as to think, oh, like, actually they're contributing stuff, they're not?
Do you know what's funny as well in this? I know there's just so much to unpack and we were talking about for a while, but you know what's also funny is the realization on certain people and certain demographics of people who are non-white into the reality of British racism and Islamophobia. For example, Priti Patel, who, you know, is notorious for kind of for many things, but she has previously kind of come out and denied that you know, there is racism in the way that there is in the UK, and that, you know, there's no problem of far-right extremism and whatever. It's funny for her to come out, and she actually used the word racist. She wrote a letter to Keir Starmer, and she used the word racist. And it is so ironic to see. And you know what else I saw as well? We've spoken on the show before about the kind of divergences within the British Asian community, and how British Indians, for example, tend to be one of the most richest ethnic minorities, whereas Asian Muslims are kind of the lowest earning minorities. There was a statement that I read from a British Indian, like, Hindu society, that basically they put out a statement, and this was so embarrassing to read, where they were like, please don't call us British Asian, please refer to us as British Indian, because Asian is too divergent of a label. And it literally, they said in the statement, they said, British Indians, we earn the most, we give the most tax, and we are upstanding. That's what they said. We are upstanding citizens. Like, basically, don't associate us with the rest of the Asians. And then they released a second statement, I think, in the midst of the riots, which were basically like, these riots are really bad. We're being victimized. Like, someone help us, essentially. You know, and it just goes to... And like, people are... And it's crazy, because it's even non-white people who are ignorant to the realities of Islamophobia and racism in this country. They think that your structural class position is going to save you. It's not. No one's going to find you in the street and say, show me your bank account. Show me how much you've got on there. Show me your P45. Show me your LinkedIn. Let me see what job you have. That's not going to happen, my friend. We're in this together.
Yeah, the literal screenings they're doing are like the one in Middlesbrough, where they're literally seeing the cars. What colour is the person driving it? If not, that's
why?
It.
Like, that's what I mean. At the beginning of this week, I nearly swore that, sorry. At the beginning of this week, it was sadistic. It was weird. I was up all night on Monday stressing. I was like, this is not safe anymore. I was in such a deep rabbit hole of like, oh my God. It was giving the purge.
Yeah, it was. It actually was.
It's not okay. Can I just say, one of the really funny things, and like, it's not funny, but it is funny, is how Premier League clubs have teamed up with their like local police authorities. So then like, whoever's been arrested for partaking in the riots is going to receive like a ban on coming to a game. And I mean, hit them where it hurts. Yeah. Hit them where it hurts, you know?
Yeah.
But like, what a joke.
Suddenly I love football.
What an absolute joke that's what this country has come to. That's right. Hit them where it hurts. Don't let them come to a football game.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Right. Well, we've been speaking for nearly an hour on this, so I think it's time to.
And I'm angrier than when we started.
Well, let's continue that anger and talk a little bit more about misinformation and Olympics. You see where I'm going here?
Iman
Khalif.
She just won gold, by the way.
Congratulations. Woo! Well done after everything. For those
her.
Yeah. For those that don't know the context that surrounds this, I think it was on Thursday. Stuff kicked off like in the run-up to this. It was the various heats. For those who don't know, Iman Khalif is a boxer in the Olympics.
Algerian.
Yep, Algerian boxer. Algerian female boxer. And she was victim of severe misinformation.
A smear campaign. Yeah. Like, we're going to call it a smear campaign. Yeah. Call it what it is.
Yeah. Amplified, and I think it's fair to say this, by J.K. Rowling.
Oh! Yeah, I'm so upset. Yeah.
Right. So those who don't, and again, I'm going to be very careful here so that I'm not teetering on defamation or anything. But for those who don't know, J.K. Rowling over the past couple of years has made herself out to be very anti-trans, essentially.
Like, made herself out to be. She has very decisively taken anti-trans positions. She kind of has been peddling her opinions on what constitutes femininity and masculinity, and in doing so has really kind of victimized a lot of trans people. She's made headlines for this, and she has, like, over the years doubled down. Like, she has been receiving a lot of backlash, a lot of criticism, and each time she just gets very, very more extreme, I would say, personally, in her kind of stances and her beliefs. But this woman is very much of the opinion that if you are born biologically as a woman, then that is what your gender is, your sex is your gender, and there is no room for kind of
yeah.
exchange, which in turn, as we said, victimizes trans people.
Yeah. So then obviously we get to this. It was a boxing match that was happening, I think, on Thursday, like I said. It was Algeria versus Italy. And Khalifa was successful. She won the fight in 46 seconds. And basically, people kicked off on Twitter, basically implying that Khalifa did not deserve to have won, and that the only reason that she won is because she is actually a man.
No, it's not even that she didn't deserve to win, it's that she shouldn't have fought that fight.
Yeah, she should not have had the opportunity to do that because
she's a man.
Yeah, which again, to clarify, she is not.
Like, she was born by a lot. It's so sad and it's crazy. And like, by the way, like, this is this again, like, really, what is at the root of this is racism and Islamophobia, truthfully. Mm. You know, it's this, it's the kind of the putting on a pedestal, like, white femininity, making white femininity the kind of central model of what femininity is, and making all women of color kind of very peripheral to that, and at terms making their femininity something that can be withdrawn, you know, by those standards of white femininity. And that's exactly what has happened with Iman. And it's so sad because her being at the Olympics, and I'm so glad that she's won, but her being at the Olympics was obviously a momentous thing for her family, for her country. And yet her father was having to do interviews showing her birth certificate to be like, hello, look, she was born as a woman, you know? And it's, and it's some, in the Olympics, or like just in sports in general, there are going to be people, maybe because of their ethnic phenotype, who have certain advantages. For example, East African people are great runners. That will be because of their phenotype, because of their climate. That is just how things work. Every single athlete has some kind of biological advantage. It's not because they've trained really, really, really hard. Yeah. They've just won some kind of genetic lottery. And
probably why a lot of them start doing that sport in the
exactly.
first place.
There's a reason why I'm not a long distance runner, if you know what I mean. But my point is, Iman has a higher level of testosterone. That's just how she was born. That's what her genetic advantage is in this sport. That doesn't now mean that she's a man. And we've seen this happen before with people, with sports people like Caster Semenya, like similar thing, where people said, accused her of being a man because she very much like sits outside of the model of white femininity.
It's just so, because it's like,
I just,
yeah, go on, Simran.
I was going to say, we don't uphold that standard for people that don't fit that stereotype of what we consider to be like feminine women.
Right, right.
And like, on the like genetic advantage thing, is like, you don't look at Michael Phelps as like insanely long wingspan or his like the way that his body is built, right? You don't look at that and say, well, eliminate him, he's something else, like, you can't,
yeah,
he doesn't belong in that category, why was he even allowed in the pool in the first place? Exactly. Right, like, nobody questions that. They just let him win by a long shot and everyone's like, fine, cool, because he trained and he worked hard and he earned it, he's the reason, that's the reason why he's like the best, right? But Serena Williams, Iman, like, all of these women that don't fit that stereotype and then have these genetic advantages, like so many other dominating athletes in their sport do, are then subjected to this questioning of their sex and their gender and their identity. There was no, like, she should have been celebrating her wins, but she had to go and defend herself in a country, I'm pretty sure, where transsexuality is criminalized. So
that's what a lot of Algerian people were saying.
The bread and butter of it. Like, what is that even going on? That her dad had to sit there with her birth certificate and show the cameras. Like, why couldn't she just be afforded the grace of just having a win?
Yeah. A lot of Algerian people were saying that. They were saying that, like, you guys don't know what Algeria is if you think that they're going to send, like, which is another issue in itself, but whatever. Yeah. You know, it is sad to see.
We look at, like, I use Michael Phelps arbitrarily as an example, but we look at that and we put it down to training and hard work. And yes, a genetic advantage, but he works hard. Why can't we do the same for her?
Yeah.
We have to call into question what it is to be a woman, because she just simply couldn't have won.
I'm also not being funny, but also it was boxing. Like, people are going to get hit. Do you know what you're, I was just kind of a bit like,
I know.
Like, she, like, again, I think the Italian boxer has since come out and apologized and whatever.
Good.
But yeah,
but it's
go
too late.
Yeah, exactly. But it's also just like she. I think she said, "Oh, I've never been hit that hard before." I'm just like,
"Okay, God, you're not a boxer.
You're a boxer.
You're just like, not. You're just. I'm so sorry. Listen,
you got sparked out and you cried.
Yeah,
about
let
it.
Me hold your hand while I say this. You're just not that good. That's it. That's really what it comes down to. But anyways, she won gold, and I'm very happy to see it. And her runner ups, I think it was like the Thai team and some other Southeast Asian team, I can't remember, but her runner-ups, fantastic. I was watching videos and crying this morning before I came here of them celebrating together, and they're all
really like
hugging
her.
Each other, and they're all, you know, whatever.
That's good.
That's what you call real sportsmanship.
Yes.
Not white woman tears.
But also, I was going to say, like, there's even, like, Katie Ledecky, the swimmer, right? No one questions her, and she dominates. On the rankings, it's just her name.
Yeah. Oh, really? Crazy.
She holds, like, all the records and, like, all the fastest times for whatever heat she's in, right? It's literally just her name.
I also think it was Martin from Sludge Mag that pointed out that it's, what's her name? Is it Keely from Near Here? Like, with
Keely Hodgkinson.
She's, like, been performed really well at this Olympics. And if you look at the race that she was in, I think she was, like, one of, if not the only white person there, and she won gold. And like,
that's because she's genuinely good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. She's trained and there was really hard one. To, like, obviously, like, if you're thinking about genetic phenotypes, all of the other black women obviously should, if we're going to look at stereotypes, be better.
Yeah,
running.
Exactly.
Yet here she is.
Exactly.
Like,
it's not to say what the point is that it's not to say that just because there's a genetic advantage that it's automatically unfair. Because it can obviously be overcome if the athlete is genuinely good.
Yeah.
And that Italian woman just wasn't clearly.
Good enough, I think we'll say it to
good
be
enough.
Fair. Yeah. But looking on to more positive Olympics news.
Yes, I've been dying to talk about this. Yeah.
Go on.
So basically, this has been really heartwarming. And obviously, I'm not even Pakistani, but Pakistan have won their first gold medal and their third ever medal in Olympic history with Arshad Nadeem, who was a javelin thrower. And the reason that I love his story and the reason why I'm just so happy about it is because that is like a quintessential story of the underdog. Basically, so for those of you who aren't aware, he won gold and he broke the Olympic record. I think the previous record was like 90 point something and his was like 92 point something. So he like really, really smashed the Olympic record. And what is fantastic about his story is that he really came from nothing. Like it's actually really quite sad as well, is that he trained by himself with absolutely no... So usually what tends to happen is that in a country, the sports federation or committee or whatever, when they have like Olympic athletes, they will train them, they will fund them, they will whatever, put all the money behind them. Arshad Nadeem didn't have any of that. The Pakistani government didn't put any money behind his Olympic training. It was in actually his village in Punjab in Pakistan that they... this is just so heartwarming. His village all pooled together to put in money for his Olympic training and his equipment. How lovely is that? How heartwarming is that? That your own government has failed you, by the way. Pakistan, I know you'll be happy for that win, but let's not forget you failed Arshad Nadeem, right? But his village picked up the slack. And it's such an amazing testament to the phrase, it takes a village. It really, literally, in this case, took a village. And he went and he smashed the Olympic record and he won gold. And you know what's also really lovely about this is that because obviously we are all aware of the kind of very deep-rooted enmity between India and Pakistan, especially when it comes to sports like cricket, for example. In this situation, however, Neeraj Chopra, who was the runner-up, he won silver. Him and Arshad, I think they have like a friendship from beforehand. And there were some really, really like heartwarming images coming out of them both kind of like embracing and hugging afterwards. And you know what? Like, I'm going to get a little bit deep and a little bit political here. But they've both come. And you know what? Hang on. Before we get there, Neeraj Chopra actually bought Arshad Nadeem's javelin. He posted, like, I need a new javelin, I have no money. He trained with the same javelin for 7 years. And then he posted somewhere, like, oh, I need a new javelin. Neeraj Chopra bought it for him. How lovely. Your opponent, you bought him the javelin. How amazing. And then afterwards, like, they interviewed both of their parents. So Neeraj's parents and Arshad's parents. And both of their mums were like, they're both like a son to me, yeah. and this is both a win. Like, Arshad's mum was like, I was praying for Neeraj as well. He's like a son to me. And then Neeraj's mum was like, Arshad is like a son to me. His win is my win. I thought, how amazing. We never see anything like this in the subcontinent anymore. And on the one hand, obviously, it's really heartwarming. It's amazing to see. But then on the other hand, it really breaks my heart because it just shows like really the kind of, I'm sorry, I'm going to make it about partition, but like it really just goes to show the horror of partition and what it has done to people who were once a community.
I think
know?
It also goes to show what can actually be achieved when people
overcome that. I know, yeah. absolutely, absolutely. But I just think all around, like, it's just such, I love an underdog victory. And that's really what it was. He won not because of the Pakistani state, but in spite of the Pakistani state. And it is just amazing. And the sportsmanship that, you know, he and the others displayed, like, it's just, I just loved watching it. Every single time a video of that comes up on my timeline, I'll watch it, no matter how many times I've watched it before. Just love it.
Well done.
Yeah, really, really well done. Pakistan, I'll let you have this one. I'll let you have it. But yeah.
Does anyone else?
Some people could take a lesson in sportsmanship.
Yes, exactly.
But also, I just think, like, as well, like, there are moments where our community really shines and we show that, like, our community is so beautiful, and like, there's just moments like this that show that. Some people
can't relate.
In the last week have they build that community on racism.
Yeah.
And it's really sad.
It is really sad.
Any other standout moments for people from this year's Olympics?
I don't really watch
why
it.
Have
I just
have
love...
I literally not watched it?
Yeah, I don't really watch it, but I just love those. Like, if I did watch it, if there's anything I love about the Olympics, it's that. It's the underdog victory thing, you know?
I will say, they are swimming in the Seine. They did it. They swam in the Seine.
Oh, yeah, because there's a whole thing about
yeah,
they
it was blocked.
Gonna do it. Or is it
when
like
I was in Paris, when I was in Paris, it was blocked.
Mm. Macron, well, they said, like, oh, it's safe to swim, and everyone was like, build a pool, and they were like, no, we're swimming in the Seine, it's safe, even though the Seine hasn't passed like E. coli tests or bacteria tests for like decades, right? They were like, no, it's safe, we've treated it, blah blah blah, blah. And then I think Macron or someone in their government said, I am going to swim in the Seine. They postponed it because duh, of course they weren't gonna swim in the Seine. And then there was all the big protests from the Parisian people saying like, we're gonna defecate in the Seine. Go France. And then it actually did happen, the swim. I think one, they're like, is it their first lady or something? I don't know who it was, but someone swam in the Seine. And now everyone's swimming in the Seine. And then everyone's like, they're swimming in the Seine. Well, it's kind of gross. Everyone's like, they're swimming faster because it's just a race to see who gets out. And the real Olympic trial is to see who survives.
Guys, I also want to mention the India's wrestling champion. Have you guys heard Vinesh Bogat, I think her name is?
Oh, the weight class thing.
Yeah. Well, firstly, like, so she's...
I think I did hear about this.
Yeah, she's India's candidate for, I think, female wrestling. And she had, again, like, speaking of kind of winning medals or succeeding in spite of your country rather than because of it, Vinesh had basically been victimized by certain BJP politicians for speaking out against cases of sexual assault and harassment in India. And I think her, along with some other athletes, had basically undergone like a whole, like a smear campaign. Like they'd had like, I think they even might have been jailed. I'm not sure. But like, it was just, they had like a really horrible kind of... time, like, you know, a really horrible ordeal to deal with. They had been like sexually assaulted and abused, and then the government had basically protected the perpetrators. Mm-hmm. I think they were like quite high up senior officials, but she went to the Olympics and she basically had won gold, but then I think, I'm not sure what the verdict is yet, but they had to disqualify her because the weight division that she kind of classified in, she ended up becoming, by the last fight, was 100 grams over.
Yeah, I think there was something like she tried overnight to like...
Yeah,
to lose the weight. Her down
and she did. She lost about 2 kilograms, but she was still 100 grams over. So I think then they appealed for her to be like the silver, to win silver instead or whatever. Which I'm not sure what the outcome of that was. But again, like it just goes to show like the kind of underdog story, underdog victory as well. Like hers was another story that before she got disqualified that I loved seeing the victory.
She did say something along the lines of like, you know, I might have like destroyed my career for trying to bring this person to justice, but it brought a lot of young girls into the world of wrestling and it gave them an outlet, because I think then a lot of money was donated to like these schools that help young girls get into sports and stuff like that. So she did say like it was worth losing my career over because A, these people have been brought to light, and also it's just helped a lot of young girls in where she's from get into sports.
See, like I just love an underdog story.
Well, speaking of underdog stories, Bangladesh, let's go for it,
guys. crazy scenes. As I say, it has been an absolutely insane time to be a British Bangladeshi. So we last left off on the show talking about the kind of protests and the riots that had been happening. Initially, they started as a result of the quota movement by the government, which reserves 30% of jobs for the descendants of freedom fighters, even though they are not otherwise marginalized. And then that kind of grew because it was then met with kind of really violent kind of responses from police and government forces and whatever. The protests then grew the movement into a nationwide movement that demanded justice for those who had been killed. And they called it a one-point demand, which is the resignation of Sheikh Hasina. Now, I have also separately spoken on the show about Sheikh Hasina and how much I personally really strongly dislike her. She is kind of what people are calling her, a tyrant, a dictator. She was heading what is essentially an authoritarian government. This is like a fact. The last election that we had just, what, seven months ago, I was in Bangladesh for it, and you know, we've spoken on the show about how it was a sham election. The opposition had essentially boycotted the election. And yeah, it was just crazy. Like Hasina had been in power for 15 years and she'd been in power. Well, she's actually been in power. First time she came to power was 1996, when I was born. My entire lifetime, this woman has been in politics. But the last premiership that she had was a 15 years continuously. I don't think that should be allowed in any government for one person to have fat power for 15 years. Like, there should have been a maximum term for that. Regardless, she in her premiership has done really, really awful things. And I'm talking about the kind of suppression of, you know, freedom of expression, political freedom. She has annihilated a number of her kind of opposition and her enemies. And I don't just mean politically annihilated. I mean, like, there have been numerous people who have been killed by government and state officials for speaking out against Sheikh Hasina and whatever else. This is all rumoured, by the way, but people who are on the ground kind of really truly believe it to be true, and so do I personally. But yeah, she has just been, in my opinion, just really, really awful. And I think that what initially had happened was that people were very disillusioned with the democracy in Bangladesh and the electoral system in Bangladesh, to the point where we saw record low turnout for the elections just 7 months ago. And I think what was amazing about this kind of round of protests, it's a revolution, that's what I'm going to call it, it's a revolution, is that it then really galvanized people that were beforehand disillusioned, who really thought that we were just going to have to stay with Hasina for as long as she lives. And eventually what this turned out to be was, as I say, a widespread nationwide revolution where they demanded the resignation of Hasina. And obviously, like, the police who are doing the government's bidding had continued to violently crack down. There were kind of deaths. The official figures are in the hundreds, like people on the ground saying it's over like 1,000, but there was just so many deaths, a lot of injuries. Bangladesh had undergone a national kind of blackout. Internet had been cut off, curfews, like the whole country had come to an absolute halt. There's not a single person in the country who has been unaffected by what has gone on. And the protesters were still, nevertheless, completely resilient and completely unwilling to back down. Hasina had obviously come out and said, okay, cool, I'm going to sit with them. And the protesters were like, nope, we don't want to sit with you. We want the release of all the hostages, the prisoners that you'd taken, and we want you to resign. And eventually then, she did. She did. Like, she actually ended up, like, abdicating.
I was going to say, I don't think it was that much by choice, was it?
No, it wasn't by choice. Yeah. It wasn't by choice. She ended up abdicating.
Yeah.
So the protesters then decided that they were going to march to Parliament. They were going to go to the kind of Parliament, to Hasina's residence, and protest there. And she kind of just was like, okay, I'm out. She handed it over. She handed power over to the military and she left. And I think she's still in India waiting to get asylum in whatever country. A lot of countries are actually denying her asylum request. The UK has denied her. The US has denied her. Whatever, wherever she ends up. Oh, actually, there's been recent development. Her son has come forward and said that she wants to come back. But whatever, I'm not going to focus on that. I'm going to focus on what is an absolute triumph. What we have seen in Bangladesh has been a revolution. Listen, there's a reason that I'm so loud and proud about being Bangladeshi. There's a reason why I say that Bangladeshis have genuinely such a revolutionary spirit. It's because we will handle our business, guys. Like, we've seen it in 52, we've seen it in 71, and we've seen it again in 2024, where we have literally toppled a dictatorship. And that is just entirely people's power. You know, it's not because Hasina was weak. She was formidable. That woman was a formidable leader. And yet the people's power has toppled her. We have seen mobilization and organization and galvanization of the people that is genuinely inspirational. And I say that because now I've seen recently that Pakistani protesters who have been protesting against the imprisonment of Imran Khan, which is a separate issue in itself, but they've now adopted Bangladesh's tactic and they're now moving forward with a one-point demand where they want, like, the release of Imran Khan. But my point is that revolution is contagious. And what Bangladesh has done is so inspirational. I'm so proud of the Bangladeshi students, of the Bangladeshi people who have managed to not just topple a dictator, not just take back their own country, not just have this renewed independence, but also in the aftermath of it. Because initially I was celebrating very tentatively. I was very worried. I thought that, you know, there's going to be a power vacuum, that it might be a little bit difficult, because that would be the perfect situation for chaos and disorder to kind of breed itself. And oh my God, every single day I log onto the internet and I see what's going on in Bangladesh and I literally cry, because I'm bursting. I'm absolutely swollen with pride for the Bangladeshi, like, students, particularly the Gen Z, because they have, in the aftermath of Hasina having resigned, appointed an interim government. Dr. Mohamed Yunus, who I've spoken about before on the show, he was someone who was previously imprisoned by Sheikh Hasina for talking out about the government. He has been appointed the head of the interim government. The students have basically taken control of all facets of society. They have cleaned up the roads. They are controlling traffic. They are dealing with, like, you know, petty crime and all of these things. Like, Bangladesh, my cousins in Bangladesh are giving us updates, like, by the hour. And I love going to Bangladesh, but one thing I hate about it is that it is generally quite dirty, like, in the streets and stuff like that. You can feel a little bit uncomfortable. My family are telling me that it's the cleanest that the country has ever been in their life. Like, I cannot believe, you know, like, it's... And you know what's also really crazy is that there have been so many onlookers. Bangladesh has always been treated by this kind of... been treated with a kind of paternalistic... like, people being really, really paternalistic and condescending towards Bangladesh, because we are a relatively new country, we are a developing country, we are a third world country. People have always been really, really condescending towards us, acting as though that we don't really know how to have democracy, we don't really know how to govern properly, we're always in political turmoil. And in the aftermath of this, we've seen a lot of people looking into Bangladesh saying, like, oh, their democracy is not going to last, like, oh, this is, you know, what they've done is actually really bad, because now everything's going to collapse and there's going to be disorder and there's going to be chaos and they don't know what they're doing. Because there's been similar things across North Africa, you know, the Arab Spring, like Egypt, for example, was a particular, like, potent kind of comparison, where they toppled the government and then the military took over and they're still there, you know, like, they have, it's been really bad. But my point is that Bangladesh is a completely different place. It's a completely different history. We're completely different people. And actually, while the whole world is looking down on us, like being really paternalistic and really condescending, it's the rest of the world that could really learn from us. Really, truly, the rest of the absolute world can learn from us. Because as I say, one thing about Bangladesh is they are about it. They are about their business and they will handle their business in a way that many of the people and many of the countries will not. Like, we toppled a dictator in 22 days. How many other countries, how many other people do you know can mobilize to that degree? Not very many. Not very many. And I, for one, I'm absolutely proud and I have absolutely full faith in the Bangladeshi people that we're gonna do amazing things with the country. So I love it.
Yeah. I mean, bringing it kind of full circle, it is just interesting / sad to see what's going on in Bangladesh compared to here in terms of what people are choosing to actually riot about, essentially. What people are choosing to put all of their effort behind.
Yeah.
And...
Oh, hang on, sorry.
Yeah, go on.
No, I was just going to... It's a separate topic, but yeah, I agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, we talk a lot on the show about, like, let's be more like France and, like, take up, like, get mobilised a bit more and, like, actually be more actionable in what we do and what we say and, like, kind of get more in front of things. But this is the kind of stuff that we're going to get in front of as a country.
Yeah. But that's Bangladesh. Like, that's why I'm so proud. That I'm such a proud Bangladeshi. Like, you guys who listen to the show will know. And that's why. It's because we are, like, every single Bangladeshi person has such a revolutionary spirit. Our national culture and our national character, like, revolution is literally embedded in us. The things that we have overcome as a country in my parents' lifetime. You know, this is like our third round of independence. You know, in the space of one lifetime. Like, I'm just so proud. But, and I do want to say one thing as well, talking about how other people are kind of reading the situation and kind of, like, trying to put us down and whatever. I do want to talk about the attacks on, like, the minorities, specifically the British, specifically the Bangladeshi Hindu community, because initially after, kind of immediately after Hasina's resignation, there was still, so her supporters are the Awami League Party and the Chhatra League, kind of the student wing of the Awami League. They are the kind of Hasina's gang, her team or whatever. And initially after she had resigned, obviously people weren't going to relinquish their kind of control or their position so easily. And in the immediate aftermath, there were some attacks on minority communities, which is always what happens in times of political strife in the country, very unfortunately. And there is obviously a history of persecution and suppression of the Bangladeshi Hindu community in particular. And unfortunately, it was Awami League people. And this is, like, on good authority. Like, my family are on the ground telling me this. It was unfortunately Awami League who had decided then that if we've lost this war, our leader has abdicated, we're going to not hand it over so easily. We're going to cause as much kind of issues and division and tension as possible before we are forced to give over our control. And they had essentially started to attack certain Hindu temples and things like that. And what has happened as a result of that, India, who we know have a very deep history of Islamophobia and a very deep history of anti-kind of Bangladeshi sentiment in particular, Hasina was a great Indian ally. Hasina, the way the politics was set up is that India really had a lot of kind of, had a great hand in Bangladesh economics and politics because Hasina was a great ally of Modi. So obviously for them, this is not a good situation. The fact that they've lost one of their greatest allies in the entire subcontinent is not a good situation for them. So they have picked up on kind of what had happened, these kind of incidents of attacks on the Hindu population. And what they have done is they have completely blown it out of proportion. They've completely magnified what has actually happened on the ground. And they've made out to the Indian population that, oh my God, the Hindus in Bangladesh are completely under attack. They're not safe. They're being burnt alive. The mandirs are being kind of absolutely desecrated. And actually what the reality is that as soon as it happened, literally the night of Hasina's abdication, that all the madrasa, so the Islamic school students, all the imams, all like religious leaders, they had physically come out in thousands. And this is something that I've heard from a Bangladeshi Hindu. She posted this. She said that she called her cousin in Bangladesh and her cousin had reassured her that there were thousands of Islamic school students that have come forward and are physically manning the Hindu temples. Like, again, this was something that I was watching all the coverage of. This, there's so many photos of Muslim people, Bangladeshi Muslims, outside of the Hindu temples, guarding the temples. And it just made me cry, because at a time where there are kind of external actors, you know, or traitors or whatever, that are trying to sow division and trying to kind of cause tension and communalism in Bangladesh, which is something that we have previously been victim to, the Bangladeshi people in this new age are absolutely rising above that. They're protecting the minorities. They are, you know, embracing their Hindu brothers and sisters and telling them, listen, this is your Bangladesh. This is my Bangladesh. This is everybody's Bangladesh. Like, I'm very, very proud of the Bangladeshi people for doing that. And also Indian people who are spreading the rumors, please fact check, because what you think is going on is not what is going on. There we go. That's all I wanted to say.
Slay.
Right. See, Simran, I was going to ask, do you have anything to say before you round things off? And there you go.
What?
Doing
okay.
It again.
No, obviously.
I'm so fed up. Every single time I text Simran, she might as well said it as like an automatic reply, like email thing. Just slow. Just every time. Today she...
I did asterisk it today, yeah. If that makes you...
Yeah, it did. It made a slight difference. Thank you for that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Noted. I would say what's been going on in Bangladesh, I've been scrubbing up on my, like, history of it and just been, like, doing my reading, my due diligence.
Yeah,
and it's just such a... I think what Halima said, like, three revolutions, three changes of, like...
Ownership,
leadership in one lifetime is insane. And, like, I would just really, if you don't know a lot about it, I would just encourage you to read up on it.
Listen, no one is doing it like Bangladeshi. That's all I'll say. That's why I'm so loud and proud.
Right. Well, that for once, that seems like a positive way to round off today's episode. Thank you to everyone that has tuned in. Hopefully next week we'll have more positive stuff to talk about. But as we all know...
I feel like this has been...
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, it's been good.
It's been all right. I feel like it's been more positive than usual.
I will say, like, based on what we spoke about in the first hour, I think this whole week I was like... I really wanted to, like, get it out and, like, pre-record or something, or just do something like ASAP. But I think actually now we have spoken about it at a good time. Like, we could almost get through the tumultuous and very highly, like, emotional part of it and actually give a bit more of a, like, rhetoric and a bit more of, like, a narrative on the whole thing and actually speak on it instead of, because if you told me three days ago, I would have been in tears just on it.
Yeah.
Guys, you know, like, as soon as anything happens, my first thought always is, get me on that mic.
Yeah.
Get me on that mic. Listen,
no, because when I tell you, it was like 4 a.m. on Monday and I was like anxious. Like, I was so unwell and I was just, like I said, I was in such a rabbit hole and I was like, I need to, like, talk to
I
you
need
guys
to be on a mic.
I was like Martin.
Honestly, as soon as, like, this is saving me, probably this show probably saves me a lot in therapy costs.
You're welcome.
Anyways, thanks for listening, guys.
Thanks everyone, we will see you same time next week.
Bye.
Until then, yeah, everyone, hope everyone's all right. Stay safe.
Stay safe.
Cool, bye.